dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have an intelligence professional in the house, fortunately, at the Center for Security Policy and with us virtually today. He is Fred Flights. He has spent his life working in and on intelligence matters, notably as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency for the better part of 20 years, and as a member of the professional staff of the House Intelligence Committee, also stints as the chief of staff to John Bolton in the Department of State, and most recently at the National Security Council. It's great to have you back, Fred. Welcome.
Frank, good to be here.
You've spent much of your professional career focused on Iran, of course. We talk about it in our weekly conversations frequently. I did want to get an update from you, Fred, as your former boss and our friend John Bolton has been worrying about the evidence, as yet unspecified, about threats presumably in the Persian Gulf region that are emanating from the Iranian regime. What light can you shed on what's going on?
Well, Frank, this is a great week because it's the week where we're celebrating the one-year anniversary of President Trump's withdrawal from the Iran deal. And one argument that the deal supporters used to make and still make is that we can't pull out of the deal because it would encourage bad behavior by Iran. And now we see that Iran apparently is planning acts of terror to respond to our withdrawal from the deal. Now, let's stipulate right here. This is not something civilized nations do. And this is not a reason that President Trump should take a particular line of action in his foreign policy. Anyway, the U.S. received credible intelligence that apparently Iran was planning some acts of terror, perhaps attacks against U.S. forces or the citizens of U.S. allies in the Persian Gulf. And in response, President Trump asked Ambassador Bolton to work with the Pentagon to send an aircraft carrier group and American bombers to the region as a sign of strength, as a symbol of American power, and the fact that we will respond to any acts of violence by Iran against the United States or allies. It is not a sign we're going to go to war with Iran, but it is a signal to Iran that we're not going to tolerate attacks on us or our allies.
Do you anticipate, Fred, that the kinds of attacks the Iranians may contemplate would be limited to what might be thought of sort of tactical strikes in the region, whether it's the Strait of Hormuz or whether it's American personnel or allies, for that matter, that we have there? Or might the Iranians be thinking of a much more catastrophic attack, one that conceivably they could pull off without fingerprints, namely against something as strategic as our electric grid? The president, of course, recently issued an executive order warning about the importance of protecting our critical infrastructure, including, of course, the grid, against these sorts of threats of electromagnetic pulse, for example. But should we be concerned about that as well, given what we know of Iranian doctrine and, well, their determination to inflict what they call death to America on this country?
Oh, Frank, I think you're onto something here. And I was speaking to a number of experts yesterday about this, and they all agreed that whatever Iran does probably will be done so its fingerprints are not on the attack. And that could be it will launch an attack with terrorist surrogates or some type of unconventional attack, such as an EMP attack on America's power grid, or maybe an EMP attack on a U.S. base in the Persian Gulf or U.S. ship or against aircraft. It is a technology that we are fairly certain that North Korea and Iran are pursuing, and it would be the type of attack that, you know, Iran may think it's difficult to trace back to Iran. I don't know how true that is, but I think we have to assume that the attack would not necessarily be a an attack by the Iranian military against a U.S. military asset, a conventional military attack in the Persian Gulf region.
Yeah, well, we have to be alive to all of these dangers, I think, and we appreciate your leadership and that of Ambassador Bolton and the president in trying to protect us against the peril that the Iranian regime clearly represents and will likely do so and lessen until it is no longer in power there. Let me turn to a different topic, Fred. A woman that both of us have known for some time, I think you better than I, is the director of the policy planning staff at the State Department. You, again, worked in the senior ranks of the State Department for a number of years. But Kyron Skinner is arguably one of the best of the people to hold that position. It's kind of the in-house think tank for the Secretary of State. She's come under intense fire for some remarks she made recently about China. What can you tell us about, well, her background, her remarks, and the sort of nature of the controversy that now swirls around her?
Kyron Skinner is an African-American professor. She studied under Condoleezza Rice. Rice was her mentor. She's an incredibly intelligent woman, and she's a senior advisor to Secretary of State Michael Pompeo. And look, she really is the real deal in terms of someone who's trying to drain the swamp and bring the president's strategies and policies to the State Department. I'll tell you, she is fighting an uphill battle. She spoke recently about China's efforts to game the United States in the trade talks and how China is a severe threat to U.S. national security. And she just got pummeled by the left. And I mean, this is simply typical. Anyone who defends the Trump administration and its policies, this is coming. And I've talked to Dr. Skinner about this, and she knew it is coming. And frankly, she is reveling in the press attention she's getting because it shows she's getting through, that she's making a difference.
Well, the old line that the Air Force uses about if you're not taking anti-aircraft fire, you're not over the target, probably pertains here. But Fred, you know, the thing that many of the critics have singled out for criticism is the comment to the effect that the United States is now dealing with a hostile ideology and that it may have the wellspring in sort of the differences in culture and even the character of the people that we are confronting in China. I've gotten to know Kyron Skinner over the years, particularly for another of the positions that she's taken, which offends the left, and that is her very sensible views on arms control, Fred Flights. And the critics, of course, are keening and wailing about the fact that the Trump administration has been disengaging from treaties that are now being violated by the Russians. And it seems to me these are the sorts of things that we ought to have a proper public policy debate about. And I salute Kyron Skinner for her contributions to that.
You know, that's exactly right. The president has a fairly aggressive agenda to fix the many messes he was left by President Obama, particularly the Iran nuclear deal. But there's other things that are being worked on. And the State Department is just working against him. And I can count on one hand the number of officials who are fighting to promote the president's policies. And Dr. Skinner is at the top of the list.
Fred Flights, keep it up. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we will speak with Carolyn Glick, an extraordinary resource on developments in the Middle East, and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is my distinct pleasure and high honor to be able to present to you all one of my favorite people in the entire world. She hails from Israel these days, but she does truly global work in terms of helping the rest of us understand what on earth is going on in the Middle East and with American policy and so much more. Her name is Carolyn Glick. She is a senior contributing editor at the Jerusalem Post and has been an adjunct fellow for us here at the Center for Security Policy. For many years has been associated with the David Horowitz Freedom Center as well. She's the author of The Israeli Solution, a one-state plan for peace in the Middle East, and also Shackled Warrior, Israel and the Global Jihad. Carolyn, it is so good to have you back. Welcome. Thanks for taking a few minutes.
It's always great to be on your program. Thanks for having me, Frank.
Let's talk about the latest unpleasantness, Carolyn, I think, to put it mildly, emanating from the Gaza Strip in the form of 650 or so rockets that have been fired into Israel, to which Israel, quite understandably, has responded forcefully. What is up with the Palestinians in Gaza, and what are the prospects that this so-called ceasefire is anything other than, well, what they call a hudna, I guess, a temporary truce, and not much more?
Yeah, well, Israel has a really problematic situation with the Hamas regime in Gaza because it's only, unfortunately, it's become clear that its only strategic option is to overthrow Hamas through military force, meaning having a major war against Gaza, against the Hamas regime in Gaza to overthrow it. And since there's nobody to replace Hamas from among the Palestinians, it would also involve Israel reinstating its military government or control over the Gaza Strip that it ended in 2005 when it left Gaza unilaterally and handed over the keys, including to the international border, to the PLO, to the Palestinian Authority. And so it's got no option right now strategically to change things other than that.
And the PLO, we should just say, is no bowl of cherries, but it's even worse that it almost immediately became a Hamas-run state that has been nothing but a festering sore ever since, right?
Well, it's become worse than a festering sore. I mean, for 37 years when Israel was in control of Gaza, it was never more than a tactical nuisance. And now it's becoming increasingly a strategic threat because even though the damage that they can cause Israel is in, you know, black on white, it's minor. The 700 rockets that they shot into Israel cost something like $14 million in property damage, which is a drop in the bucket. But it's not exactly true because over 300 of them were intercepted by Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile shield, and each one of the Iron Dome missiles cost another $65,000. So, you know, it adds up in the end.
And the loss of lives as well.
Exactly. But that was the one point I was getting to, is that what you're actually talking about is their ability to make life impossible to live in southern Israel at will. Because what we've seen here is a quadrupling of the intensity of the rocket and missile launches against Israel from Gaza over the 2014 war. That war lasted 51 days, and during the course of that war, Hamas and its allies launched 4,400 missiles and rockets at Israel. And here in the space of 48 hours, they launched 700. So that's more than four times more in intensity. And it's just the fact that they're able to make life impossible. And yes, despite the Iron Dome protective shield over Israel from these kinds of projectiles, five Israeli civilians were murdered. And, you know, again, in 51 days of fighting in 2014, four Israeli civilians were killed. So, and now we have a much larger coverage of Iron Dome over Israeli territory than we did in 2014.
In addition, Carolyn, talk about strategic threats. The Hamas faction has been building these underground tunnels to attack Israel. They've been sending fire kites across the border to burn its forests and kibbutzes and so on. This is a mortal threat, in other words.
It's an enemy that learns, it adapts, it uses everything that it has at its disposal, all of the money it has at its disposal, all of the materiel it has at its disposal, to build weapons to attack Israel. That's all it exists to do. It's a genocidal terrorist organization, and all it exists to do is attack Israel. And so it's really a problem. And I think that what Israel really has to look towards, given sort of the precariousness of the situation and the fact that even the people who are saying that, you know, it's not so terrible or whatever, acknowledge that the ceasefire, such as it is, isn't going to hold past Ramadan, which ends on June 5th. So, you know, you're talking about going back to this sort of routine of having to spend your entire life in a bomb shelter, because if you come out even for a second, you can be killed as one of the victims.
Let me just regroup on this. You say that Israel's only real option, if it wants to diminish this threat in a material and sustainable way, is to go in again, which would entail an unbelievable degree of fighting.
But that's the thing, is that I don't think that that's the only option. That's the only option that can strategically change the situation for now in a sort of more or less permanent way, whatever that means. But what we have now is a more problematic situation than we have to have. We've lost our deterrence against Hamas. It's clear that the reason that Israel isn't targeting Hamas and Islamic Jihad commanders in a significant way is because they've deterred us. Otherwise, we would. And so we have to change that calculus. And to change that calculus right now, so this ended just like previous, the last three ceasefires have ended with them getting money from Qatar and Israel enabling them to expand the fishing areas off the Gaza coast, even though that's a maritime threat to Israel.
And these are the things they're demanding more of at the moment, right?
Right. And so they're getting cash for ceasefires. They're getting ceasefires for, they're giving ceasefires and getting cash. And what we need them to go back to is a situation that held for the 2 years before this past one, which is ceasefire for ceasefire. So they get nothing and we attack them, and we don't attack them. If they don't attack us, we don't attack them. Because right now, if they don't attack us, we let them have money. And that's the problem. And so we have to strive to end that, and we strive to end that, in my opinion, by going after their leaders, not going after simply their homes, which is what we did this past time, which is a welcome move, but that we should actually be taking out their terror masters.
You want to attack their homes when they're in them, in other words. Carolyn, let me switch gears. Hamas, of course, about which we've been speaking, is the Palestinian franchise of a group called the Muslim Brotherhood. And Hamas's violent behavior is evidence of the true character of that operation. We have for a long time in this country indulged in the idea that, actually the Muslim Brotherhood is a nonviolent organization, and therefore it wouldn't qualify as a foreign terrorist organization, which I personally believe it absolutely is. The president is apparently now brooding once again an idea that he had some discussions about early in his presidency, namely effecting precisely that designation of this group. You've written about this. Tell us why we should designate the Muslim Brotherhood and what would be the benefits of doing so.
Well, you know, as I wrote in this piece that I wrote last week in Breitbart, since 2001, as you know, the Bush administration adopted a policy of looking at terrorism as an isolated issue away from the societies that inculcate jihadist violence and jihad and Islamic terrorism in their members, and then revere people who become suicide bombers and the rest of it. That is, they've been looking at terrorists as sort of every single one of them is a lone wolf. They're not operating in any sort of social milieu. And that was the rationale that obtained during the Bush administration. And that was, of course, the rationale that obtained on steroids really during the Obama years. The problem with it, as we've seen in America's failure to defeat its terrorist enemies, is that the milieu is more important than the lone terrorist, that so long as the swamp itself is flourishing and getting money and indoctrinating children to want to become jihadists and all the rest of it, then you're going to have a pool that never dries up of potential trigger pullers. So the Muslim Brotherhood for Sunni Muslims is a swamp. It is the pool. It is the milieu that these people operate in. And we saw it, you know, this past week with the revelation of the jihadist indoctrination that's going on in Philadelphia, by a Muslim Brotherhood aligned organization, the Muslim American Society, where they were indoctrinating school children in the United States, in the city of Philadelphia, to seek the annihilation of Israel and to seek to commit jihad, Islamic holy war, to achieve Islamic global domination. And so this is the environment that the Muslim Brotherhood cultivates everywhere that it operates, whether in the West or in the Middle East or anywhere else. And that's why it's significant. And, you know, the first step that President Trump took in this direction of going after the milieu was his decision last month to designate Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps a terrorist organization. And everybody said, well, you can't do that because that's the regime itself. That's essentially the SS core of the Islamic regime.
Carolyn, we have to leave it at that. We're hard over time. Thank you for so much of what you do at the Jerusalem Post and your books and other essays, notably at Breitbart. Look forward to talking with you again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're going to take a tour inside the economic war room with Kevin Freeman, its star and our guest today. Kevin is, of course, a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy. He's also the author of two terrific books, Game Plan and Secret Weapon. He has a terrific blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com, and is, as mentioned, the star of an extraordinarily valuable television product now on Blaze TV, and you can find out more about it at economicwarroom.com, how you can subscribe and view the analyses and the blueprints for action that Kevin and his team put together regularly. It's a terrific resource. Kevin, great to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, you and I were at something last week that was quite extraordinary. It was the Electromagnetic Defense Task Force meeting at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. Tell us what that was about, Kevin, and why it is important that we be addressing the electromagnetic spectrum as a, well, as a battle space domain.
Well, it was a rather extraordinary event, Frank, particularly given the past, I don't know, 5 or 8 years that you've been on this topic. The fact is I've watched and Washington is opposed and the industry is opposed and everyone's opposed to you actually just trying to protect our electric grid. And what happened recently in March, the president gave an executive order that just said the government, the military, and the private sector should work together to solve this problem. And Lieutenant General Quast, who is in charge of all the Air Education Command in the Air Force, called together something like 300 of the top scientists, engineers, specialists to get together on multiple tracks and talk about whether cyber was a risk, whether EMP, high altitude nuclear explosion EMP, or from the sun, a coronal mass ejection, or any other threat that could happen to the grid, microwave weapons and so forth. And they really all came, you know, into a room and several rooms, and we discussed the threat, and it was treated as valid, which it is. There was no tinfoil hat aspect. There was even one of my friends who was a brilliant guy that I knew in high school, went on to get a PhD in applied physics from Cornell. He was there, and I looked down, and I was like, wow, I know him. And I went and sat and talked to him. These are really smart people coming together, talking about a very genuine threat that the United States faces to our electric grid, which is actually then a threat to our way of life, our very existence as a nation.
It is indeed. And listen, back at you, thank you for the attention that you've been paying to this, both on your program, Kevin, and of course in your book Game Plan. This is a critical, critical moment. And I'm very grateful to President Trump for his leadership with his executive order. But in my commentary today, talked a bit about how at a moment when we're sending a carrier battle group into the Persian Gulf to protect our interests from the Iranians there, we better be attending with at least as much urgency to the vulnerabilities we have here at home. And this is a moment to do that. You have put down a marker, Kevin, though, that a good piece of what's going on here, particularly the resistance of the electric utilities to hardening or otherwise protecting their assets, is economic in character. You've also discussed that the Chinese, or for that matter, others who understand our vulnerability, may be thinking about this in economic terms as well. Economic warfare is, of course, your specialty, and it's the main thrust of a lot of the unrestricted warfare the Chinese have been particularly waging against us. Put all these dots together, if you would, Kevin, and tell us what we need to be doing in addition to thinking through the hardware and software issues associated with improving the grid's resiliency.
Well, this is one of those areas. We talk about existential threats to our country with settled science. This truly is settled science. I mean, we know this. We've seen it in practice. It fits models and theories, and the science is really settled.
And yet, Kevin, let me just interrupt, because we did have the Electric Power Research Institute just last week issuing a report saying, oh, nothing to see here, folks. We've got it all under control. No worries.
Well, that is a classic case of garbage in, garbage out. They used models that made certain assumptions that are not necessarily real world or military level assumptions. You know, I talked to some of the scientists and they said, oh, yeah, I looked at the EPRI report. And what it basically says is if you have this yield and you use this amount of energy and so forth, it's unlikely to hit more than a certain percentage of the transformers and switching and all of that. And they said their assumptions were so off base, so light. You know, the military models, which are extraordinarily sophisticated and have looked in depth and detail based on our actual experience, which is much of it's classified, but also, are much more sophisticated models. The science is absolute. When you have a pulse of energy of that magnitude, now keep in mind, EPRI is the same research institute funded by the utility industry. It's kind of like letting the tobacco companies fund the Surgeon General.
Thank you for smoking.
Yeah, exactly. They're not giving a really valid perspective. The truth is the science is settled. And for the Chinese, the science is settled. They have not developed sophisticated super EMP weaponry, as have the Russians, as the Iranians. It's all in their military doctrines. They didn't do that because they thought it would fail. They've tested, they understand, the models are clear. So yes, people may argue with the truth, but this is a case where their arguments are junk science and the science is settled. To our adversaries, the issue is economic. And to us, the reason that they, from my perspective, that they would do that junk science approach is because they don't want the financial responsibility to protect the grid. That's what they're concerned about. I've privately been told that, hey, this would be from a foreign adversary, therefore it's a foreign attack, therefore the military should pick up the cost. This is not our responsibility.
Yeah. I think that's certainly part of it, Kevin. My sense is that there are other considerations as well that go to, you know, being told what to do with their assets, and secondly, perhaps even more importantly, that they're a little uncertain what would happen if they started tinkering with them to make this very complex grid of ours resilient as well as very reliable. I did want to commend to our audience a really important piece that was featured in National Review last week, authored by three individuals closely associated with the best study that's been done to date of all of this, settled the science, if you will, the Congressional EMP Threat Commission. Dr. William Graham, its chairman, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, it's a longtime staff member and chief of staff, and one of its advisors, R. James Woolsey, former director of Central Intelligence. It's a very powerful and well-done piece. Kevin, let me switch gears to ask you about one other thing. We have, of course, seen a lot of evidence that the Chinese are operating inside our own country in ways that are quite problematic. I did want to ask you about one particular issue. The company that's known as Foxconn has been building chips. It's a Taiwanese company nominally, but most of its chips are now manufactured in China. It is announced on, I gather, several occasions, but most recently last year, I believe, that it was going to create a huge plant for making semiconductors, chips, whatever, in Wisconsin. And the state of Wisconsin has gone to considerable expense. I think it's something on the order of $300 million to create infrastructure and other incentives for this company. And it's nowhere to be seen at the moment. Its president actually is currently running for the position of president of Taiwan, which is an interesting development as he seems to owe much to his sponsors in China. Can you walk us through what the implications are of these kinds of investments not materializing for the local economy, of course? The reliance on foreign supplies of chip technology, even if they're manufactured in this country, or worse, in China itself?
Well, Foxconn has announced in December, I think they announced that they had a $9 billion plant that they're building in China. You know, there was once this perspective that if we had global economic interconnectedness, it would make for a more peaceful world. And the idea that we would do business with the Chinese as often and as broadly as possible. Foxconn semiconductors are actually the future of basically our economy and the world. I mean, they're essential for everything that we're doing in artificial intelligence and 5G and all of the different things that we talk about. And now to see the Foxconn have these incredible investments in China and connections to China, then you think, well, running for president of Taiwan, I don't know all the details of this story, but it looks like a classic bait and switch where the Chinese have promised lots of benefits to Wisconsin or any other American state at the same time that there's an involvement with China and political control. This is all a part, it looks like it's all a part of the digital Belt and Road, which is literally an opportunity, every chance to advantage China and disadvantage the local community where the investment's to be made. They get the locals involved and then it doesn't materialize. So I don't know the specifics, but again, it looks just like the Belt and Road, just in a different from different views.
I'm so glad you brought this up because we will have today on our website at securefreedom.org a very important paper written for the Congress by former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, which talks at length about one particular front in this campaign of the Chinese to dominate the world digitally, namely the 5G network that it's building through its arm known as Huawei. And Kevin, we've talked a lot about that over the years. We'll be talking more about it in the days ahead, I know, but I do want to commend everybody Speaker Gingrich's important assessment of where we are and where we need to be with respect to 5G. That'll be at securefreedom.org. Kevin, we have to let you go. Thank you so much for your time today, as well as the great work you're doing at Economic War Room and globaleconomicwarfare.com. Next up, we will speak with Michael Waller, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Mike Waller is in the house, Dr. J. Michael Waller, professor and extraordinary national resource when it comes to matters involving things like, well, information warfare, influence operations, black magic, like political warfare more generally. These are the things he's taught about, he's studied closely, and he has practiced a bit, including now as the Vice President for Government Relations in the Center for Security Policy. Mike Waller, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Nice to be back with you, Frank.
So there's a lot of evidence that foreign governments are interested in engaging in influence operations in our country. The Russians, of course, have been very thoroughly discussed in this connection, notably, if sometimes misleadingly, with regard to the so-called Trump collusion allegations. But evidently, there was a lot of work they were doing with Fusion GPS on behalf of Hillary Clinton's campaign. But talk a little bit about the Russians and the tradecraft and sort of standard operating procedure, I guess you might call it, that involves these various influence and information and political warfare strategies?
Well, Russia's been practicing this political warfare strategy and changing it and calibrating it as needed for the better part of the past century. So it's nothing new for us. What continues to be surprising is how we always act like it's something new, and we're shocked that they might have tried to meddle in the 2016 election when they'd been doing this in almost every election since 1924. So they're very good at it. They have a combination of their own intelligence agents who have been recruited as foreigners, including Americans. We don't know really who they are because we don't have the counterintelligence to track them anymore. But even some liberal commentators in the Atlantic magazine, for example, have recently come out and said, we know these penetration agents are still there and they have been there for a long time. We just can't find them. So that's undisputed that these agents are still in place. And we can kind of guess who they are, but can't prove who they are. So they're there in academia, in the media, in politics, and in finance and business. But they're also using a parallel set of paid sort of mercenary agents who will do whatever they are hired to do for whatever client they will do it for. So those are some of the more pernicious ones as well, because even though they might be known, because they served in government posts before, we're talking about registered agents as lobbyists and so forth, even though they served in government posts before, or precisely because they've served in government posts before, they're recognized authorities in their own right, so we don't tend to think of them as foreign agents when we hear them speak.
You've described a very serious problem, Mike, which is not just what the Russians are trying to do, but the inadequacies of our counterintelligence operations to even track, let alone effectively counter them. This is true in spades, as I understand it, with respect to the even more comprehensive, aggressive, multifaceted, well-funded efforts the Chinese are making to engage in influence operations and information warfare and the like in this country. Can you talk a bit about that?
Oh, yeah. As bad as the Russian problem is, the Chinese problem is far, far worse. We don't even have a grip on that as a country. We have so many political and media and business and educational figures whose livelihoods depend on doing the work of communist China that it's so pervasive around us, we hardly even see it. We're talking about everything from your traditional sort of covert agents of influence all the way up to American Fortune 500 CEOs who know that they have a financial interest in appeasing the Chinese Communist Party, and they'll say whatever needs to be said in order to change public opinion and government policies to benefit the Chinese regime, because that in turn benefits their businesses.
Can you give us a sense, Mike, of the role that specifically is played? You spent a lot of time in your distinguished career in academia by these so-called Confucius Institutes that are on American campuses, in terms of both promoting a party line, if I could use that expression, and in essentially precluding those who have a different view from enjoying access to the campuses or the classrooms or the curricula of what American young people are being taught.
Well, the Confucius Institutes were set up by the Chinese Communist Party on dozens, if not more, American college campuses. And they were set up, the National Association of Scholars just did a super study on this. They were set up on the campuses and funded by the Chinese government, which would then in turn determine who the faculty members are and the nature of the curriculum being taught. So this was designed, these institutes were designed not only to indoctrinate American students who would then go on to become diplomats and intelligence officers and military officers and journalists and businessmen. It was also an intelligence recruitment method so that they could assess and begin recruitment of Americans before they began their professional careers. Very dangerous thing. And so it had this on the one hand, Chinese communist political warfare indoctrination on our campuses, and secondly, recruitment of Americans to serve as Chinese spies.
And to the extent that, again, our counterintelligence services are not up to snuff, presumably both that opportunity and the presence in this country on academic campuses and in research institutes and in various companies across the country of Chinese nationals who are either voluntarily or being coerced into serving as collectors for the Ministry of State Security in China, we are massively outgunned in terms of the espionage piece of this as well as the information warfare piece, are we not?
Oh, sure. Just think, the number of communist Chinese nationals at American universities who are spying on us outnumber the entire bureaucracy of the FBI.
And that's not entirely assigned, of course, to trying to keep track of what they're up to. The Bureau has many other responsibilities, and the counterintelligence arm is a relatively small operation. All the more worrying. And let me ask you about one other piece of this, Mike. The Washington Post publishes with great frequency a paid supplement that is, as best I can tell, produced by Chinese communist propaganda operations. There's a very fine print warning that this is just an advertisement, as they say, but to most readers, I suspect it's treated as just another source of news about what's going on, albeit from the Chinese perspective. Give us just a flavor, as a practitioner of these arts, what value that could have in a paper that is considered to be, an indispensable resource by much of official Washington.
Oh, it's of incalculable value. In the print edition of the Washington Post, which some people still read, it's an 8-page insert, and it's made to look like a special insert on news about China. And the disclaimer doesn't say this is a paid propaganda ad by the Communist Party of China. It simply says this is published in cooperation with People's Daily or whatever other Chinese Communist Party institution was sponsoring it. So it makes it look like a media joint venture between the Washington Post and a Chinese media outlet when it's simply a Communist Party organ. You have to wonder, why does Jeff Bezos really, what does he gain as the owner of the Washington Post from publishing Chinese propaganda? And why in the world would a self-respecting news organization lower themselves to this? The Russians pioneered this, by the way. It was an 8-page Russia news, quote, news section in the Washington Post, and the Chinese copied that model.
Mike Waller, much more to talk about in connection with all of this, but I appreciate your time today. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.